Hello, and thanks for turning on The Blender, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's weekly podcast. I'm Bruce Jacobs, a producer at RFERL, and I'll be your host this week. In this episode, the granddaughter of former Yugoslav leader Josip Broz Tito talks about her father's legacy and why the Belgrade native decided to make Sarajevo her home.
This specific spirit which Sarajevans had, their sense of humor, their tolerance, their capacity to understand everything is something which I really appreciate very, very much, and that's why I like to live with them.
And playing it loud and proud in Kabul. Afghanistan holds its first outdoor rock music festival in more than 35 years. But first, the people and events surrounding the assassination of President John F. Kennedy have long been fodder for conspiracy theorists. The unusual activities and travels of his assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald, have only increased suspicions that he was part of a larger plot. In 1959, Oswald, an American citizen, traveled to the Soviet Union and later asked for asylum. He then went to live in Minsk, which is now the capital of Belarus. RFERL's Belarus service director, Alexander Lukashuk, has just written a book, Trace of the Butterfly, which is the story of Oswald's stay in Minsk, which ended in 1962. I should point out the book has only been published in Belarusian, but the author is with me now in our Prague studio to talk about it in English. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Bruce.
Well, my first question is, can you give me a little background on the genesis of the book? Many volumes have been written on this topic. Why write a book about Oswald?
I could have written a journalistic research about Oswald like 20 years ago. I didn't want to. This book is not a journalistic research at all. It's a literary research using the methods and instruments of literature to study, analyze, and resurrect the time, the place, the people.
What did people in Belarus know about Oswald's life in Minsk? You know, what else is new in your book?
There were two groups of people. One group was extremely well acquainted with minute details of his life. These are KGB surveyors. He was followed basically 16 hours a day, only when he went to bed and got up. There was not a group of people following him when he left his house, went to his factory or took a tram and went to the city center, and they wrote detailed reports. Later, they installed also surveillance equipment in his apartment, so they were able to follow him when he was home. But deep at night, there was no usually a person in the next apartment listening to him. So basically, these people knew what was going on, and they were reading his emails, his mails, his posts, regular letters, detail. As for the rest, nobody knew about him. Nobody spoke about him. Only his colleagues in the office and a couple of translators knew them. And they kept silent for all these years. For the rest of the people, the first time they found that Oswald was in Minsk was 1990.
There are KGB files on Oswald that are still secret. Why is that?
Well, it's a very simple answer. Because they are in KGB. Because the Secret Service still is called KGB. And it means it keeps to its own traditions. Dzerzhinsky, who is the founder of KGB, is still his monument is in front of this building in the center of Minsk. His portraits are everywhere inside. They still claim that they are the same service. So they keep their methods. They believe they should keep them secret. Their informers, people who worked for them, and everything they have, they can declare that is a state secret. And that's what they did to the Oswald files.
Do you think there are any bombshells in there, or you have no way to know, or you just think they're just trying to cover up their methods?
I don't think there is anything to hide of any value. In fact, the guy who was supervisor of Oswald, a KGB colonel, when Kennedy was killed, he was summoned to Moscow, and he was told to deliver the files, the Minsk KGB files, to Moscow, to Lubyanka. And he said that his idea was that Khrushchev would immediately give these files to the Americans because they showed very clearly that KGB in no way tried to recruit Oswald or use him in any way, that he was absolutely of no interest from this point of view. And he said that he was absolutely sure that this would immediately remove all the questions whether the Soviet side was in any way involved in the assassination.
Now, you interviewed people who knew Oswald. What kind of insights did you gather from that?
Well, maybe one of the most famous of those who knew Oswald was former or first head of the independent Belarus state, Stanislav Shushkevich. Stanislav Shushkevich, who signed the document about the collapse of the USSR with Yeltsin and Ukrainian President Kravchuk, was a young engineer in 1960, and he worked at the radio factory in Minsk. And one day he was summoned by his bosses and told that he's given a very important task to teach Russian to a new worker who happens to be an American. So he was actually given a task to teach Russian to Oswald. He was his first Russian teacher, and of course his recollections were quite interesting. But not only people who knew Oswald were of importance for me in writing this book, memories, things which other people did helped to recreate this atmosphere, the life, and were even perhaps in some things more important than people who knew Oswald.
Now, the book summary says that Norman Mailer is a protagonist in your book. You interviewed him. How does he play a role in your book?
See, Mailer and people with him, Lawrence Schiller, somehow made a deal with the KGB in 1991 when the Soviet Union was collapsing. And they got access to the archives. It was a very short, brief moment in history when it was possible. The files at that moment, when they started negotiations, were in Moscow. And Bakatin, the last KGB chairman, basically made a decision to go public with them. But then the internal bureaucracy intervened and tried to stop it. But still he was pressing for it, and in November 1991, Izvestia, the Russian newspaper, even published an article saying the Lee Harvey Oswald files are to be open and accessible kind of next week. What happened during next week? The head of the Belarusian KGB, General Sherkovsky, called Bakatin and said, most of these files are about Minsk and our people, so we need to vet them. And Bakatin said, well, that's natural. So they returned files to the KGB. A couple of weeks later, there was no USSR, there was no Soviet KGB. Bakatin lost his job, and the files got back to Minsk. And Mailer still continued pressing. He got to Minsk. They met with Shushkevich, who was head of state. He held them, and they got access to their files. So he was the first and only civilian researcher who saw these files, who was given xeroxes of certain pages, and who could talk to the KGB officers who worked with Oswald. So that was extremely unique. Neither me nor my friends, who were, say, members of parliament at that moment, had access to this file. Of course, when his book was published with this unique perspective, unique material, I called Mailer. He agreed for an interview. We had a long talk, and I can tell you only one episode. At the very end of the interview, I asked him, Mr. Mailer, can you imagine the situation? So you came to Minsk, you met many people who knew Oswald, you read transcripts of surveillance reports, you read transcripts of from his tape talks, you saw his letters which were intercepted. And can you imagine that, say, 10 or 15 years later, a new researcher comes to Minsk and who wants to write a book about you? And he finds out that you are also followed, that your phone talks were also listened to, and that there are KGB reports and surveillance transcripts of you now in KGB files. And Mailer said, that sounds like a great plot. And he started laughing. That's how it ended.
Well, what's your assessment of the Mailer book?
There's no mistakes. It's extremely thoroughly researched, the Minsk part of which I can speak with expertise. He met about 100 people. And one thing which was very important for him was the quality of memory. People in the United States of America who were exposed to a huge amount of documents, theories, discussions, interviews about assassination of Kennedy, already, Mailer's idea was, already could not distinguish between what they really knew or what they think they knew or what they heard or what they were hinted to. The memory was compromised. In Minsk, everybody was keeping silent for 30 years. So he got virgin memory, and he was extremely impressed with this. And that helped him to really recreate very exactly, accurately, things which happened.
So you think your book is sort of a companion, something to be read alongside Mailer's book?
My book is much more deals, of course, not with Oswald, but with this period. That it is extremely difficult, really, to resurrect the past. I can the first line in the very first sentence of my book, that on January 7th, 1960, at 8:23, the train from Moscow brought to Minsk an American who, it took me more than a year to finish the very first line, not the sentence, the very first line, to find out exactly when it happened and at what time it arrived.
Any chance it's going to be translated to English, or you have to read it in the original Belarusian?
I'm not sure. But we asked, of course, for permission from Mele State for quoting, and we got this permission. I'm not sure if anybody is interested. It's not about, frankly speaking, only about Oswald. It's about a time and place, how a person who comes with illusions, what happens, how his illusions disappear. I'm talking about Oswald, but also about context, about fun, irony, Orwellian reality, but also very practical things. Basically, it's much more, I would say, funny book than very serious, academic research.
Okay, last question. A lot of people think there was a conspiracy. The Warren Commission said it was a lone gunman, Lee Harvey Oswald. What do you say? Did Oswald kill Kennedy? Was it a conspiracy?
We had a book presentation in Minsk, and I signed maybe 150 books. Only one person through all those 150 people standing in line, only one asked me this question: what do I think? Who killed Kennedy? I can tell you, why don't you read the book?
We'll leave it at that. Alexander Lukashuk, director of RFURL's Belarusian service, thanks for joining us at The Blender.
Говорить радіо.
Зараз радіо Сунда, контекст вершина
башня. Радіо Фадо, по шума.
Говорить радіо Свобода. А за тицюн, КТМ.
Svetlana Broz, the granddaughter of former Yugoslav leader Josip Broz Tito, has been battling ethnic intolerance for two decades. Her 2002 book, Good People in an Evil Time, chronicled acts of goodwill by Bosnians of all ethnic backgrounds during the war. Broz also runs the NGO Garivo, which facilitates ethnic tolerance. Correspondent Irina Lagunina spoke to Broz during a recent visit to Sarajevo.
You are originally from Belgrade, but you moved to Sarajevo permanently after the war in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Why did you decide to move?
I lived in Belgrade, which was a European metropolis 30 years ago. But unfortunately, in the meantime, due to the politics and wars which were waged on the territory of former Yugoslavia, Belgrade somehow lost the spirit. I worked during the war in Bosnia and Herzegovina. The half of wartime I spent in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And after the war, I dedicated a lot of my time working in Bosnia and in Sarajevo. And I realized that Sarajevo somehow kept the spirit of the city, in spite of the fact that the citizens of Sarajevo passed through the worst of the siege during the war 92-95. Not knowing to live in the city without spirit, I decided to move from Belgrade to Sarajevo. Of course, a lot of my works were connected with Bosnia and Herzegovina. My search were connected with this country, and that's why it was easier to make such kind of a decision.
And what kind of spirit did you feel here in Sarajevo?
Those people who lived before the war in Sarajevo, Sarajevans who were born here, who passed through the siege, they kept the feeling for others, they kept the compassion, they kept understanding of everything. And it is something which I really appreciate. Of course, every city changed a lot of things after the war which the city passed through. A lot of people left the city, a lot of new people came to the city, etc., etc. And it happened with all cities in former Yugoslavia, not only with Sarajevo. But this specific spirit which Sarajevans had, their sense of humor, their tolerance, their capacity to understand everything, is something which I really appreciate very, very much. And that's why I like to live with them. And that's why I moved in October 1999 from Belgrade to Sarajevo.
But Bosnia remains split along ethnic lines. Many Serbs have moved to Republika Srpska or East Sarajevo. Some even say that Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic, on trial in The Hague now for genocide, actually won the war because the divisions are more pronounced now. There is even some segregation in the schools.
I work in schools very often, and I can tell you that in Sarajevo it's impossible to find the segregation in the schools. It's possible, unfortunately, in some places such as Mostar, such as Stolac or Gornji Vakuf, but not in Sarajevo. I think that I lectured at almost all secondary schools in Sarajevo, and I never find the segregation. But if we talk about percentage of inhabitants, it changed according to the census of 1991, although nobody made a new census in the meantime. It's clear that a lot of people left the city and that a lot of some new inhabitants came and inhabited the city. And there are changes. But those people who stayed and who were before the war in Sarajevo, I repeat my theory, but it is everyday's practice, in Sarajevo, they cannot accept any segregation and any changes because they lived together before the war, during the war, and they stayed to live together after the war. So the new people who came from other places, maybe as the victims of ethnic cleansing, etc., you know, who are now inhabitants of Sarajevo, maybe they have a kind of frustration which they are bringing.
And what do you think about the young generation that was born after the war? I heard both in Banja Luka and here in Sarajevo that they don't know each other, they are separated, and they are even more nationalistic or ethnically oriented than the generation that lived through the war. Is this true?
I think that it might become true one day if we as members of the society do not enough to change that. Because those, I would say young people, of course, they are 16 now because the war was ended 16 years ago. They have no chance to meet each other. They are separated according to their school plans, school curricula, according to the lack of money for traveling, and of course influencing the particular society in which they live. But there are chances to change this situation. You know, NGO which I run organized the 8 days schools of civil courage, inviting young secondary school students and university students from all parts of Bosnia and Herzegovina as well as from the whole region of former Yugoslavia. And they spent 8 days together.
Why do you call it civic courage?
Civil courage is the term which we use because we realize that the people in this region has a lack of civil courage, which we defined as capacity for resisting, opposing, and disobeying to all those who abuse their power for their own purposes and violate the laws and violate the human rights of others. There's so many of them among politicians, among professors at the universities, teachers in the schools, you know, my colleagues, physicians, in police, in the judiciary. All parts of the society are corrupted. And so many phenomena are negative in the society, which means that people need to have a civil courage to stand up and to fight for their rights, to say no in the face of evil, to say no, I do not accept to be, you know, exploited or to become a victim of your own purposes and interests just because you have a power and I have no. And that's why we develop plans how to educate the young people to resist, to understand their role in the society. Our young people have no any income data that they are individuals which do have their place in the society and their role in their own lives. They're always slaves of somebody's other's ideas. And they grown up that way. Somebody should tell them that. And we are doing so.
Svetlana, what do you consider to be your grandfather's greatest legacy?
I think that the greatest heritage should be the anti-fascism. For me, it is no doubt. And I would like to be sure that for other people it is the same, because Tito was the one among the very famous anti-fascists during the Second World, before the Second World War, and during the Second World War. That's why I was raised in such atmosphere, and I was very sensitive to every sense of fascistic ideology or ideas which might appear around. Unfortunately, we were all victims of the very fascistic ideas and ideologies which are still very present in our societies. And people do not resist enough, according to my point of view.
That was Russian service correspondent Arina Lagunina speaking with Svetlana Bros.
Just a reminder that The Blender is the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe. RFE brings radio, internet and television news to 21 countries across the former Soviet Union, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq and the Balkans. If you'd like to get in touch, it's very easy. Drop us a line at podcast@rferl.org or leave a comment on the Blender section of our website. And remember, you can download episodes of The Blender from our website or by subscribing on iTunes. A new episode is posted every Friday.
In Afghanistan, the former Taliban regime was notorious for banning music. After the regime collapsed, music returned to the country's homes, cars, streets, and markets. But something was still missing. Until recently, there had been no outdoor rock concerts in Afghanistan since the 1970s. Correspondent Ron Sinovitz has the story of a rock music festival that electrified audiences from Kabul to New York.
Live rock music has returned to Afghanistan after more than three decades. The first rock festival in Kabul since 1975 was more than just a one-day event. During September and October of 2011, musicians from Afghanistan, Kazakhstan, and Uzbekistan came together for underground concerts and jam sessions at cafes and other secretive venues in Kabul. The Rock Central Asia Festival was launched in Brooklyn, New York in mid-September at a club called The Hive, where organizers replicated what they called an illegal rock bunker concert. Festival organizers explained to the New York audience that security concerns had forced the Kabul events to become stealth concerts.
Festival co-producer Daniel Gerstel served as an MC at the New York event.
Texts, emails, and those kind of things, kind of as an underground invite, kind of like a flash mob or a rave.
Yeah.
And so the exciting thing about this is that, you know, journalists and security people all over Kabul are sitting there with their 24/7 with their cell phones and their radios, just waiting for it to light up because there's been a bombing or a rebel attack. But this time, when all their phones light up, it'll be, the concert happened.
Artists from Afghanistan, Iraq, and Iran told the New York audience about the difficulties of being rock musicians in their homelands.
Shayan is a rock musician from the Iranian band Casualty Process.
I was in jail for, because of music. We had a concert in Iran, in Tehran, and we were just covering some songs from Nine Inch Nails, Pearl Jam, Audioslave, or Red Hot Chili Peppers, and so on. Yeah, the police officers attacked into that garden, and they arrested all the people, included us, and they put us in jail. They punished or they fined our band for $50,000.
What?
Hide my head, I want to get my sorrow. Not tomorrow, not tomorrow. And I find it kind of funny, I find it kind of sad.
Sahar Muradi is an Afghan-American writer.
Knowing that there are projects like this where people are going back to basically empower people to improve their lives and to make art, to make music, it's really inspiring. And I think
Back in Kabul, the highlight of the festival was a six-hour outdoor concert in early October in the historic Babur Gardens. Rock, funk, heavy metal, electronica, and blues music was something never before experienced by hundreds of people who live in the deeply conservative Muslim country where music had been banned under the Taliban regime. The Kabul festival had a distinctly Afghan flavor. Alcohol was banned, and the music was stopped twice in the late afternoon so that the call to prayer from nearby mosques would not be drowned out by the sound of electric guitars and drums. Faisal Talal Mustafa is a heavy metal rock musician from Iraq.
When you're a kid, what you want to do is like live your dream, you know. Just try to live the moment, you know, being a musician, live for the sake of the music. Wow, so rock do exist, you know, especially in a traditional sort of society. Kids was like actually trying to find out what's been happening, what's going on. Like, is that for real? Are you guys really playing music? It's not like we're lip synced or something, but yeah, we're trying hard.
When the music was over, festival organizers in Kabul said they were too exhausted to think about planning the next rock festival in Afghanistan, but they promised that it's sure to happen again.
That was correspondent Ron Sinovitz reporting. And that's all we have for this week. I'm Bruce Jacobs. Thanks for turning on the blender. From Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.